Good morning, everybody from the Covey Club. This is Leslie Jane Seymour, and I'm so glad to have you at CoveyCast this morning. I have a really special interview with Eileen Gittens, who is the founder of Blurb and a former founder of many other entrepreneurial startups, some which were really, really high-flying. There was Salsa, Personify, Verb, and many times had the explosive growth and being the top of her game. And then, of course, various crashes that happened. She's been up, she's been down, she's been all around. And she wants to talk to all of you about being an entrepreneur and being a female entrepreneur and being an older entrepreneur and what it takes. And I hope you will enjoy this wonderful discussion with Eileen. She has a new product, which she is out there working with, which is called bossygirl.com, BOSSYGRL.com, which is a platform for Generation Z, which is women born between 1995 and 2012, to create and grow entrepreneurial ventures. And you can do it on your phone. It's for you. It's for your daughters as well. And she literally sets it up so that you can start a business in 20 minutes on your phone, because she wants to change what's happening out there in terms of women having the entrepreneurial experience and getting funded. She took it into her own hands. This is her new project. And she is helping young women and all of us do the next thing that we want to do. So I want to welcome Eileen Gittens, and we're so excited to have her. So Eileen, let's talk a little bit about where you grew up and how did you find your way into being an entrepreneur?
So I grew up in California, in Marin County, just on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge. And it turned out that was a very favored place to have grown up, both from a culture point of view and also from a Silicon Valley emergent point of view later on in my life. The way I found my way into becoming an entrepreneur, I really credit my family. I credit two things, my family and swimming. My family,
swimming, because okay.
I grew up, I'm number two of four children, so I'm not okay. The oldest and I'm not the youngest. My family raised us, both of my parents raised us to, honestly, from a very early age, believe that we could and should do things that were meaningful in the world, and that we really had the skills and the upbringing to be successful at whatever it was that we did. My father's from England and was very much of the mindset of, you know, when you turn 18, it's like, good luck to you. Hope it all works out, right? So, I mean, literally, I paid my way through school with student loans and paid them off when I was 31 years old. And that was not a hardship as much as it was a rite of passage in my family. It was like, buck up, pull up your own boots, get on with it, right? And, you know, and with love, right? Mm-hmm. The second thing I'll credit is swimming. And I mentioned this actually to a lot of women. I do talks every now and then, Leslie, as you know. And recently I did a talk with a group of entrepreneurial women who are in their, I'm guessing, late 30s and up, who are looking to reinvent themselves. Mm-hmm. And I asked them how many of them had children, and huge raise of hands. Then I asked how many of them had daughters, and a huge raise of hands. And I gave this piece of advice, and that was, have your daughters join a team sport, not just an individual sport, but a team sport in school, after school, whatever. Because what I learned from age group swimming, and then I went on to continue swimming into college, was a sense of discipline of you just have to show up. Mm-hmm. And honestly, and this, I know your audience is largely female, so I'm going to go out there and say this. Even when you have your period, you got to get in the pool. And you got to do the workout. Mm-hmm. And it's not about how you look. It's about how you perform. And it's both an individual sport, meaning you're on that starting block all by yourself, terrified. But it's also a team sport because you have team events. And so I learned how to compete and how to win and how to lose as a swimmer. And I find that girls who grew up competing and learning early, like boys do naturally on the, you know, on the baseball pitch, you know, on the soccer pitch.
Yes.
Learning how to win and how to lose and how to compete is just crucial. And sports is just a fantastic foundation for that.
Right. Interesting. And a lot of women say that, and a lot of the research says that also, that, you know, women who do exactly what boys did, which was grow up on teams, learn how to get up there and get out there and do it again. And that's what men kind of learn. And
yeah,
that's great.
I agree with that. I really do. I mean, it's the discipline not only in the sport itself, but here's what else it does. It teaches you time management, because when you're young and you've got a morning practice and an evening practice, you've got to come home from practice. Mm-hmm. Then you do your homework. Okay. Actually, then you have supper, then you do your homework, then you shower, and then you go to bed. And then you get up at 5:30 the next morning when you're a little bit older, right, you know, your teen years, to go to a morning workout, and you do it all over again. So you really have to figure out and prioritize your time so that you get your work done. And I will tell you, swimming in particular is just interesting. I've done some research on this. The GPAs of people who are swimmers are off the charts. And I think there's a reason for that. And the reason for it is that when you're in the pool, you are literally sensory deprived. And so your mind is running through everything you learned that day. I used to think I didn't study. I studied all the time in the pool.
Oh, how interesting. So talk about how that links to being an entrepreneur, because what my listeners are going to be interested in is, how do I apply that knowledge? And what are those specific things? So you're saying time management, you're saying discipline, you're saying getting yourself out there. You use those regularly that you learned as a kid applied to being an entrepreneur today, right?
That's right. And taking risk, okay? Because you're up at bat, okay, you're on deck, you're on the starting block, you are risking failure, public failure, in a very public way, right? Letting yourself down, your coach down, your team down, yourself down. Mm-hmm. And you are also risking, and I use this word deliberately, success. Because a lot of people are afraid of winning, because then they set a high bar for themselves in the future.
Yes. I think that's a very interesting point. I find that with myself sometimes when I'm, you know, especially being a first-time entrepreneur, when I wake up in the morning and think like, oh my God, I can't do this. It's not going to work. I'm going to fail. And then the other side of it, you say like, could I be afraid as well that it takes off? And then what do I do? You know, like, you have to ask yourself both.
You do. And I think that those early years, and I had no idea, by the way, about any of this when I was swimming. I was a kid. I'm just, you know, having fun and on the team, right? It's later on that I appreciated, oh, wow, that all happened very early. And here's the other really amazing thing. Over the years, as I've run different companies, the number of women that I find out later that I've hired or the team has hired who were either swimmers or were on a competitive sports team early, like, and I mean, you know, 10, 11 years old, 9.
Right.
It was off the charts.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your first part of your career, which is San Francisco, office of Eastman Kodak. And you said there were wins and failures there. And why did it fail, and how did you deal with that kind of failure?
All your listeners out there who thinks, you know, life comes easy for an entrepreneur or knows differently, I'm no different. So out of school, it was a recession and jobs were very tough. And I studied photography and journalism, and I was so interested to work for Eastman Kodak Company. I stalked them for an entire year before they hired me, because there just wasn't a job. So,
and what year was that?
1983.
Okay.
So in 1983, I joined Kodak, and they literally, you know, they were interested in me, and I stayed in touch. I followed up. I wrote letters, blah, 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 to stay ahead of it. And finally, when a job opening came up, I was hired. So that was part A. Part B is once I got hired, it was into an imaging systems group. So it was very technical. And I didn't have any kind of a technology background at all. I was interested in photography, but I didn't know about digital imaging, right? And so this was very early days for digital, and I had to get up to speed quickly. It's using this swimming metaphor again, sink or swim, right? So it really was, okay. Because it's like, okay. So I had to learn about that, and it was great. I had such opportunity with Kodak. I mean, I started out in sales. I was selling large-scale enterprise imaging systems to Fortune 500 companies. I ended up being asked to speak very early on at a conference in D.C. about emerging new imaging technology. And while I was there, I was approached by a guy in the audience who was with Kodak. I didn't know him. And he said, "Would you like to move to the U.K.? We're looking for an evangelist." And I'm like, "What is that?" Sounds interesting. What is it? And he said, "We need somebody over here who is literally going to evangelize this new technology into our emerging markets in Europe." And I said, "Let me go home and talk to my husband." So went back, talked to Jonathan, and we decided to move to the UK. Now, my parents, fabulous. As I mentioned, my dad British, so you know, I had family there. And it was a great experience. I mean, at the age of, I don't know, Christ, I was very young. I found myself really being responsible for a large team of people, all of whom were men, and significantly older than me. And a lot of funny stories ensued about how, you know, this American woman, girl, really, you know, was over there and running the show and all of that. It was the best of times for me. It really was. I really had to figure out how to fit in and stand out culturally and professionally, mm-hmm. all at the same time. We felt very entrepreneurial inside the company, and we thought we can go out there and raise some money and do something interesting. We wanted to apply what we knew from Kodak to the pharmaceutical industry for imaging systems and build some new software to manage that. And we thought Seattle would be good because there were all these people from Microsoft and we could attract people. This was my first big failure. I mean, first really humongous failure. I thought that we could just go out there and with a good business model and good business plan, raise money. All of the venture capital lists that we met with, subsequently I realized, they all looked at us like big company people. And you know what? We were big company people. And what I mean by that is we thought we were so entrepreneurial. We were entrepreneurial inside a big company where there was an HR group and there was this and there was IT and infrastructure and people would return your call because you were from Eastman Kodak Company, right? Mm-hmm. Now we're nobody and we did not get funded. Wow. So there I am having moved Jonathan and myself back out to the West Coast. In Seattle, no job, no prospects. What am I going to do? Seriously. And by the way, Jonathan is a builder, so I was always the chief consistent breadwinner in the family. His business would be very sort of spiky. And so it was really up to me to, you know, earn the consistent paycheck. And I thought, all right, what am I going to do? I ended up joining the Washington Software Association, which was a way just to network with people in Seattle because I really didn't even know anybody there. We just moved there. Mm-hmm. So through that, I got a job offer at a pre-IPO company called WellData. I won't spend a lot of time on it. All I will say was that I did very well there. I became a vice president, the only female vice president in the company. I was running a database software startup within a public company, basically. While I was there, we were public, so we were private when I first arrived. And that group became the Salsa division of WellData. And so basically, this was my first experience being a general manager where I owned a P&L, and fundamentally I was financed internally as an its own entrepreneurial group. So it was fantastic. I really felt like we were running our own company. We were located in, away from the head office. We had our own building. I grew the team from, three of us to about 40 people. And we were a high flyer, so much so that when the company's flagship product revenues started to decline a bit, they wanted to bring us back into the mothership and find a way for us to reintegrate with the parent company, which was not successful.
Okay,
And
interesting.
it just did not work. I lost a lot of people from that organization. They didn't want to go back into that kind of
Right.
enterprise, corporate culture.
Right.
So there I am now, having moved to Seattle, had this wonderful success, and then again, the big corporation, and at that, making moves that were outside my control. I'm sure many of your listeners might know this story well because they may be subjects of downsizing and pink slips and reorgs, et cetera, themselves. So I went
Yes,
through
and if
that
they
early in
don't
my
think
career.
that they can be, they need to be aware that you never have any idea when this is coming. And even if your division is doing well, it may have nothing to do with you. And I think that's the problem that a lot of women tell themselves, which is, well, if I just do a really good job and I work really hard and my division is doing very well, I should not be affected. And I know many women who have been shocked when they've been pink slipped, even after they had an up year, but it has
Oh
nothing to
yeah.
do with them.
Yeah. I mean our division, I mean we PC Magazine at the time rated us one of the top three products of the year. I mean
Yeah,
the
this is
product that we built
common.
at Salsa. Yeah. One of the
I don't
top
know
three products
why.
of the
Do you have
year.
a sense, Eileen, that women are more naive about this than men, or do you think men are caught as equally blindsided by these kinds of things? I
No, I
wonder
do
if
think
women
women
are
are more naive. I
more
was
thinking
more
that
naive.
there's fairness there, that if you work really hard and do really well, it's going to all pay off in the end.
Yeah, that's the princess story, right?
Okay.
And I think as young girls, we hear those kinds of stories. Prince Char someone else is going to save you,
Right.
or it's all
Interesting.
going to work. You're going to end up marrying the prince and live happily ever after. There's some of that I think that is endemic with females. I think the other reason why women are more susceptible to this is, we've been socialized from an early age in school to just be, do your job, be nice, raise your hand,
That's
right?
right.
In
That's right.
class, get good grades, right? And
And
then,
somebody will notice and come along and tap you on the shoulder and give you that promotion.
that fairy godmother will be there for you. And reality is that, even when you're successful, when you are working in an environment where there are others, right, whether they're investors or the mothership, you're always at risk. You're always at risk, right? So you have to keep reinventing yourself and staying relevant in whatever you do with your skills and your connections, because this can happen to you at any time. And it's one of the reasons, honestly, Leslie, at that point, I was like, okay, I need to go back to Silicon Valley. Back where, my home and where the internet was happening big time. This was now 1996 that I'm talking about. And I wanted to finally do a real startup, not just a sort of run my own show in Europe within Kodak and run my own show within this software company in Seattle, but actually run my own show. And
And is
mistakenly,
okay, go
I
ahead.
will tell you, mistakenly, I thought that that meant that I could control these things, right? If I was running my own company and I wasn't a division within some other larger business, I could control it. Well, that's also not true. And so my own story, and as you're hearing from me, is one of going from learnings to learnings to learnings to learnings and understanding how the real world works in the sense of needing to stay relevant and stay connected because you it doesn't matter. Even if you own your own business, downturns happen in your own company,
Yes.
right?
That's right.
So you, yeah, so it's just a fact. And you just need to get on with it, you know, get back up on the starting block, ladies, you know, and swim the next race, right? That's the deal.
So your next starting block, which we'll talk about quickly, because I want to get into your more current things. It was salsa and then personify and verb, correct?
Yeah. So I moved back to the Bay Area, and I got connected with some VCs, and they said, we've got this interesting group of guys out of Stanford, and they've got some technology. Go over and tell us what you think. And that became Personify. And Personify very quickly was an early tool for e-commerce. We enabled advertisers to understand what was working on websites and what wasn't, and also website owners do a better job of designing their website to give a better experience to their users. This is very early days. Okay. Big win, huge win. Okay. That was a high flyer. Personify grew that from the three of us to 120 people. I bought two other companies.
Oh my God, okay.
VC financed, I mean, big win, driving very quickly, double digit millions in revenue, but not yet profitable. And when the Web 1.0 collapsed during the big recession and the whole environment out here in California in the Bay Area just took a dive, we did too, because you could not raise another dollar of VC. There was no money. And if you were caught without being profitable, and some of your listeners may remember, you know, the pets.com kind of stories, right? That's what happened. And so all of us who were running companies at that time were either leaving town, on the beach, hanging out, or scrambling for what to do next.
Okay, that doesn't sound too bad to people trapped in New England, but that's okay. I understand the pain anyway.
Yeah, and when I say on the beach, maybe I should say beached, not
on
the beach.
That's different. Okay.
Yeah. Not getting a suntan, like beached, as in I don't know what I'm going to do.
So how many years was it going well for? And then when it crashed, how long were you out?
Yep. So from 1996 to 2001. So late 96.
That's
about
a nice high flyer moment.
Yeah, about three and a half years. Yep.
Okay.
So
like
it was a huge way. It was the classic Silicon Valley startup culture. You know, we had parties every time we got around to financing, you know, the whole thing. It was fantastic. We were young. We didn't know what we were doing, but we knew enough and we built some amazing technology. And we thought that would never end. We thought we'd go public or somebody would buy us for a bajillion dollars, and the market crashed.
So then how did you get to Blurb from there?
Yeah. So what I learned from that is markets can crash too. It's not just companies make different decisions, right? So from there, I went to Blurb. And basically what happened was there were no jobs. I started consulting. And during
that
period.
This is 2004. Period, is that right, Eileen?
Yes. This would be, 2003, 2004, right? Because there was another little startup in the middle there that lasted till 2003. But in 2003, I felt I needed a cathartic experience. I had been, oh my God, running Personify and then the second company called Verb, two VC-backed startups, plus, you know, moving all over the world. It was crazy. And I started photographing again because this is my first love and a real cathartic, you know, personal creative expression for me. So I started calling people and emailing people that I built these companies with and said, hey, you want to hang out for a day? Love to take your photograph. I'm doing a personal project of chronicling photographically the heroes, the unsung heroes of the Web 1.0, the first commercial web. What do you think? Mm-hmm. Every one of them said yes. And for a period of about a year and a half, I spent 3 days a week consulting and 2 days a week photographing or printing. And I calendared myself, and that's what I did. And during that time, of course, these people knew each other, and they all wanted prints because this is just the very early stage of digital photography. Right. And so I was still printing in a darkroom as well as starting to print digitally at home as well. And pretty soon I got to the place where it's like, I can't keep making these prints one at a time. I'm a perfectionist. It takes too long. And I thought, I these are good friends, but, you know, this is crazy. And I thought, I've got to come up with a solution. So I thought, I'll go online and I'll look for a way to make a book, right? A photography book. Why not? And I'll order 50 copies and I'll send one to everybody who was a subject of the book and thank them for their efforts on behalf of the various companies we'd worked to build together. And to my surprise, this is in now 2004, it wasn't there. And I kept checking back with the Google every few months to see if, you know, maybe I'm asking the search terms incorrectly. And I was really surprised it wasn't there. And finally, my husband, who is really the love of my life, said to me, "You do know this is your next company."
Okay.
Yeah, he knows me better than I know myself. And I said, "Yeah, but you know what? I don't think I can get funded." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, because everything's going digital. And here I'd be saying, I'm going to take all of your digital content, these mountains of digital content, back into analog, back into print. And I'm going to make actual physical books one at a time and like ship them to people. I don't think VCs are going to fund me." And he said, "Yeah, but you know what? It's like a lot of things. Whenever there's a new technology, the old technology doesn't necessarily go away. It just becomes more specialized and more niche, mm-hmm. and it can still mm-hmm. be a very large market." Mm-hmm. So with that sort of like blessing and "you go, girl" from my husband, I really started to look into this, and I realized, and I knew it after having been a photographer my whole life, it was the Holy Grail to have a beautiful photography book. And I kept mm-hmm. looking, and this was in the very early days. Apple started to have a photo book.
Several Apple books, yes, for my kids.
Yes, and there were a couple of others, but, you know, they were more like photo albums, not a real book.
They were. You know, that's right.
Yeah, and I'm like, no, I'm too much of a creep, you know, to do that. I'm a fine art photographer, and this is all black and white work. And I thought, no. If it's not a proper book, I'm not going to do it. So I got serious then about, well, what if I was going to do it, right? What if this really was a business? Let me look into it. And this is a piece of advice I have for your listeners. I learned very early on that when you have an idea for a new company, to talk to everyone who will listen to you. Don't hold back. I talk to so many, especially young people, who think that they need to keep it very tight and very close.
Yeah, everybody's afraid that someone's going to steal their idea. And I have heard from innumerable entrepreneurs who say, that's not going to happen. Keep talking.
Leslie, you're exactly right. That's exactly right, because it's all about execution. Ideas are a dime a dozen. They really are. It's all mm-hmm. about executing on the idea. And the chance that someone you would talk to on the train might have the same love for your idea and be able to execute, it's like one in a zillion.
Right.
What I learned from this is that if you don't tell people what you're up to and suggest to them what you need, then there is no way that they will be able to help you. And
that's
I have received so much help from strangers on buses, on trains, on planes, you know, in a cab, whatever, all over the place. When I tell them what I'm up to, and they say, "Oh, do you know so-and-so? Let me introduce you." It's amazing. If you put yourself out there with that kind of energy, it's amazing what will come back tenfold.
And I do that, and I always thought it was a fault, but I think, you know, I tend to talk and try to get as much input as I can. And I always think it's better to get as much input as you can.
Yes, exactly. Through those conversations, I ended up meeting some printers up in Seattle, bizarrely, where I used to live, who had been doing printing for Microsoft. And of course, Microsoft was moving into, you know, shipping a CD with their software, no printed manuals. And so they were at a moment where they were looking to turbocharge their print. Mm-hmm. I basically got them into the business of printing one book at a time in very high quality. These were commercial printers, right? Big commercial printers. And I got a commitment from them that if I got financed, if we got financed, that they would deliver this print product at these prices, assuming some basic volume. With that in hand, literally a PowerPoint deck, I recruited some people to be on my advisory team. This is another piece of advice I have for your listeners. Find some people who are passionate and interested in what you're up to and genuinely want to participate and or help. They may or may not have interest to join your company. They may be people you've known from the company you work with now. I formed a what I called the kitchen cabinet.
Right.
And we would meet once every few weeks, and I would basically ask them, could you do X for me? And they would. And my commitment to them was when and if we got financed, I would make sure they each got a grant of stock. I couldn't tell them even how much. It was a relationship based on trust. And to this day, every one of those people got a grant of blurb stock, and I'm in touch with every single one of them. So
Can you
getting
say
that.
what percentage you ended up giving out to those people? Because that's
Oh,
always a big
sure.
issue, which is like, I think the advisory board number now is 0.5 or 0.25%.
It's even less. It was even less than that for me. So I
Okay.
wasn't talking about very senior people. I was talking about people who would basically do work for me, like act as an employee,
Oh,
except I couldn't
okay.
pay them because I had no money. So all
Yeah.
in, I think of that there were about eight people all in. I think I ended up giving up out probably about at 1% of stock
Altogether.
between, yeah, altogether, eight to
Okay.
ten people, something like that.
That's interesting.
So yeah. And as much as anything, they were doing it to help me. But
Yes.
I wanted to make sure that you should get you need to get paid something, and this is how I can pay you now.
That's right.
So that was hugely helpful. It enabled me to really build out my whole business model and plan, have a professional deck together, a good story, a good pitch. They were my sounding board. And I went out with a couple of them who were interested to join the company, potentially, if we got financed. And we made the rounds around VCs. And what ended up happening, I've kissed a lot of frogs, ladies. I mean, it was hard to get it financed because I was doing something that was very contrarian to the time. I
And
was,
here you
taking.
are, tried and true entrepreneur. You've had a couple of wins and you still had a hard time. I mean, the numbers for women are even more horrific than just generally. I think it's at 2%, correct? Of
It's yes.
women CEO'd entrepreneurial
Yes.
enterprises get funded at all, correct?
Yeah, and you know what? I didn't know that at the time, which was probably to my benefit. I never even this is naive, I'm sure now, but at the time it never even crossed my mind, honestly, that
That's
being a
interesting.
woman looking for money would be more difficult than being a man. I know that sounds ridiculous, but at the time, I had come off of such successes in big companies that where there were other women, and Kodak was a very egalitarian place to work. And even in the software company in Seattle, I was in a software company that was go, go, go. It was very much more of a meritocracy. And so I will tell you one brief story. After I got Blurb financed with the first round of financing, a couple million dollars, I was then out looking for a B Series B round, and I knew we needed to raise, a fair amount more, like 6 or 7 million. And I was at a VC conference, and of course there are no women there. And by this time, I realized how unusual this is. And I'm into the company now, maybe a year and a half. And we're in the San Jose Convention Center, in this huge convention center. There's a bio break. I go into the women's room, which is like at a stadium. There's like 84 stalls in this bathroom, right? And there's one other woman there besides me. One. I'm not
Don't
kidding.
tell me you met in the ladies' room.
Yes, there was no line in the women's room. This was the upside.
Hilarious.
The downside was there was a sea of white men wearing khaki pants and Brooks Brothers shirts and t-shirts. That was it, right? And this woman said to me, we're talking, and she said, well, didn't you find it difficult to raise financing? And I looked at her, and I remembered actually being offended by the question.
Oh, interesting.
Because I had just closed a second round, and I said, well, apparently not. I just closed a round of $6 million. And she kind of looked at me and said, oh, well, you know, good for you. And I remember driving home that night thinking, God, I never even considered that. Maybe it was harder for me. But then again, how would I know? I've never been a man, and I certainly have never been a man with that business plan and pitch. So hard to know, right? So I'm sure it was harder in retrospect, Leslie.
Right.
I just didn't even think of it as a question at the time, interestingly.
Right.
So quickly then, what happened was with Blurb, we really became a high flyer. I grew that company from bootstrapping it, credit card debt, to over $75 million within a period of about 8 years. It became the kahuna in the self-publishing category for illustrated books. We were known for books that had graphical content, whether it's photographic, illustrations, etc. We ended up doing books for, you know, MoMA and the Tate Modern and Ralph Lauren and, you know, Moms and Dads and cookbooks and, you know, across the board, all kinds of books. And our business model was you could use our tools or yours to lay out your book. You upload your file and we'll print your book for you as there is a customer, whether that's you or somebody else. And we were international in scope. We did more business outside the United States than in. Due to my learnings at Kodak in my early years, I understood the European market, having lived in Europe for 3 years and building that out. So we really became all that. And what I learned there, and this is, I'm going to lead you up to what I'm doing now with Bossy Girl. After running that business for a decade and growing it literally from me, myself, and I, and, you know, a couple of hardy souls to, I don't know, 130 people, something like that, and $75 million in revenue, I got to that place where I wasn't doing things that I enjoyed doing or honestly felt I was really a superstar at. I was competent. You know, I was competent. I'd been around it. I mean, I can build a pivot table, right? But it's not where I live, right? And I struggled with, what do I do? I mean, I'm the sole founder of this company. I'm the face of this company for so long. And I've built it. It's my baby, literally. And, you know, how do I extricate myself from this? You know, how do I do that while preserving my reputation in the industry? How do I not disappoint my team? Oh, God, it went on and on. I had the great good fortune of having a really solid board of directors, and in particular, a couple of outside board directors that I talked to about this privately. And through those conversations, they suggested maybe I could become executive chairman. And I remember saying, okay, what's that? and basically the answer is you bring in a CEO, a new CEO who runs day-to-day operations, who has the skills and expertise that you know the company needs now. You help hire that person, you know, help the recruiting process, et cetera. And then, honestly, it's your job to be whatever that person needs you to be. And you have to accept that.
Okay. Interesting.
Yep.
So you're doing that.
Terrified. Okay. What if we got a jerk, right? And fortunately, what ended up happening was one of our board directors introduced me and us to a guy that he used to work with. And by this point, Gordon Krovitz was the board director, formerly the publisher of the Wall Street Journal, actually. Rhodes Scholar, well-known guy, super smart, basically said, Todd Larson, is somebody you should meet. And Todd was the then president of Time Inc., where he ran all of the print and digital weekly magazines worldwide. Huge resume. I couldn't believe we could attract somebody with a resume like that, honestly. And it turns out we could. We did. Todd has now been the CEO of Blurb for the past year and a half. And I have moved into a role of advisor to him when needed. I now get to attend board meetings as opposed to being at the pointy end of the stick. And most of all, what it's enabled me to do was to think about the next startup, which is crazy because this is going to be my fourth. This is my fourth one. And this was born out of a speaking op I was doing for Blurb at a publishing conference about a year and a half ago. Stop me anytime here, Leslie, if we're still good time-wise.
Yeah, we're still good. We're going to speed to the end, though. So let's talk about Bossy Girl speedily.
Yep. Speedily. So Bossy Girl happened as a result of my speaking at this conference in New York. And a bunch of women came up to me afterwards and wanted to know about becoming a female CEO. And it made me go back and how did I get funded and what do you wear to a VC meeting and all of that. I went back to my hotel room that night in New York, being on West Coast time, and I started researching, well, what is the state of funding for women? And it was worse than I had imagined. I hadn't had to raise money in a while, and I didn't realize it actually gone the other direction. It had gotten worse. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
93% of all funding dollars in 2015 in the United States went to 100% male teams. So right then and there, I thought, this is my passion. This is the next thing I'm going to do. This is the give back at this stage of my career. I want to help build products that will enable the next generation of female entrepreneurs to have a fair shake at it, to have an even playing field so that when they enter the workforce, if they have a great idea, there will be gender parity as best as I can help make that happen. So here's what we've built. I and two co-founders, both of whom are men, by the way, because this is not just a female problem. Men have to be part of the solution.
That's right.
We built an app called Bossy Girl. It's B-O-S-S-Y-G-R-L. You can get it at the App Store, download it for free. What it does is it enables women, you know, aspiring female entrepreneurs, especially young women, Gen Z girls, get them young before anyone tells them they can't, to build a real e-commerce business on their phone. So they get to name their business, choose from our set of logos or use their own, upload their own, create products like, you know, phone cases and hats and bags and t-shirts, all the things that young people want, and then sell them in their very own store with their very own URL. All supported by coaching and mentoring that's in the app, as well as through Facebook Live events and recruiting women who have interesting roles and journeys to talk to girls about what they do and how they got there. And underlying this whole thing is a give back to social entrepreneurship. I really believe that now, as we do well as entrepreneurs, we need to give something back. And so we are reserving 5% of our net profits to donate to women-supported causes. And right now we enable girls to do that through, encouragement. But in a future release, we'll actually enable them to designate a percentage. So that's
awesome.
What I'm doing now. We're just launching. Shortly, we're announcing our first partner, which is Girls Inc. of Alameda County, which is fantastic. We're talking to other partners as well about how they can introduce their young women to become entrepreneurs. And it's been a fantastic place to be at this stage, Leslie, because I am doing things now that I am really terrible at.
So you're learning again, right?
I am doing things that for years I've had teams of people doing, and I know what they are, but there's a huge difference between knowing what they are and actually being competent at delivering. So it's been humbling, seriously humbling, and exciting to develop new skills and talents and understand more of the things and appreciate, honestly, the teams that I had who were so competent at the things that I am now so incompetent at doing. That it's really been, it's just been a great learning experience. I just feel completely revitalized to be I don't know, to be building a company, again, like Blurb, I'm so passionate about. I so believe in the mission. I so want to do my part to help young women have that fair, square, even deal when they enter the workforce where no one could tell them they can't because they already are doing it. They already speak the language of e-commerce mm-hmm. and business. And mm-hmm. and they'll be able to enter in a place that will hopefully, you know, be give them every opportunity. So that's what I'm doing now.
Awesome.
And yeah, that's
so
where,
we can go to bossygirl.com and download yep. it, or we just go to the App Store and download it to our phones or give it to our daughters.
Sure. So you could go to bossygirl.com and learn all about us. And right from there, there's a link to the app in the App okay. Store. Or you Great. Can go directly to the App Store. And yes, for your daughters. Okay. And in fact, a lot of women who have small businesses are using Bossy Girl to build their own kind of marketing swag for their companies because okay. it's so easy. I mean, you can Great. Build... You can build your company and a whole store in 20 minutes on your phone.
Fantastic. Okay. Yeah. So that's great for our listeners. So the last question I have for you before we get into our pointers to take away, though you've given a lot, which is terrific. Can you just describe how your lifetime love of learning impacts your sort of mobility and your entrepreneurship?
Oh boy, that's a great question. I have been a lifelong reader. I typically have at least two books going at any time. I am just one of those insatiably curious people. I hear about something and then it's like, how does that work? And I've got to go and find out about it. I think that sort of discipline and that sort of honestly passion for just learning all the time, staying relevant, staying fresh, is what makes you open to ideas. In fact, maybe even your next idea for the next thing you're going to do. In between all of these startups that I've done, I've gone into a mode of being a sponge. Literally, mm-hmm. I'm conscious of it. I'm like, oh, what's that? I read something. I'm like, how does that work? I see a movie and I think, well, you know, where do those people learn how to do that? If you can force yourself, and it doesn't take a lot of effort to just think of yourself as in taking all the incoming in, just all of it. Don't push things out. Just take it all in, and then your brain will sift through the things that resonate with you, and then out of those things will come the thing. That's how I've lived my whole professional career.
So learning leads to reinventing, which leads to your next project, most likely.
That's right. And
awesome.
And every time you take on the next challenge, you build your arsenal of skills, which gives you, frankly, more confidence to be able to go out and think, well, all right, I figured that out. I should be able to figure this out too. You know, yeah, I don't know how to do that, but I'll learn about video production today. Sure.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm in that moment of like, oh my God, put a gun to my head. I can't learn one more piece of technology. I'll kill myself.
I understand.
It's such a learning curve when you get out there and have to do all this by yourself.
It's so true. I've been inside companies now, even startups that had, you know, an IT department. So if I needed something, I just, you know, emailed somebody or ask my assistant to, hey, go find Fred, and, you know, it'd be done. Now right. I'm like, okay, I have to install Trello and Skype and
right.
Slack and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Yeah. So let's end by, if there are three main tips that a reader can, or a viewer or listener can take away today from this conversation about being an entrepreneur, and about reinventing, what would yeah. those three things be that you would hope that they would garner from your advice?
Yeah, well, I have spoken about a few of them, but the fundamental to all of them is you just need to believe in yourself and surround yourself with people who believe in you so that when times get tough and you really doubt yourself, because, you know, being an entrepreneur is just, you know, I'd laugh, but when people say, how's it going? I'll say, ask me in 10 more minutes.
Right. Because it's hard. I will tell you, it is a roller coaster.
It really,
it is really
isolating. Last night,
really
I didn't sleep well last night. Cause I'm sitting there thinking, oh geez, I've got to get this off the ground. I got to do that. You know, da, da. And there's three people in the company. Right. So right. It's like, there's only three of you. You got to get all this stuff done. It still all has to happen.
It's scary.
And you don't even know how to do it. So
that's right.
if you can just fundamentally just believe in yourself and just say, I know I can, and just repeat that mantra to yourself, and then surround yourself with other people who are rooting for you as your cheerleader, and frankly, who you can call when you're despondent, okay?
Yes.
Not only when it's all good, you need people around you when you can say, it's not good. Talk
right.
me through this, help me through this, right? So that's
right.
number one. Do not try to do this by yourself. It's emotionally very challenging to do, and it's very rewarding, and you just need cheerleaders along the way and people who will tell you true. People who
yes.
will tell you the truth. So that's number one.
Yes.
The second one is I already mentioned this, and it's a sort of an adjunct to it, and that is be that sort of sponge. Stay open to ideas. Even if you think you've got it, continue to read, be online, go to listen to podcasts, honestly. Read
the podcasts
voraciously.
Are great. I found them very helpful.
Very helpful. If you can, go to some conferences, some other female conferences. I will tell you that for so many years, I had a 100% male team, or I mean, executive team, or very nearly that. I had a 100% male founders, I mean, not founders, investors, board of directors. I would speak at conferences where routinely I would be the only woman speaker. Got to the point where, you know, I didn't even notice it. And now I am living in a world that is so radically different. I can't believe I didn't take advantage of this earlier, which is women now are very supportive of other women. Women in business are very supportive of other women in business. So if you can go to a conference or two and just network with some other women, that's a fantastic thing, both professionally and personally. You make some great friends. So that's number two. And then number three is really just, I don't know, grit, true grit, right?
Yeah, it's grit.
It's just grit. You just hang in there. Know that, you know, it'll either happen or it won't, but no matter what happens along the way, you will learn a tremendous amount.
Yes.
And you'll take that with you to your next gig.
Yes. You have to look at it that way. I've already had to pivot once and it's really hard. And the whole way up the hill, you're saying, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if this is going to work, but I hope it works. And
yeah.
You just have to keep turning it over and turning it over, no matter which way the trail pushes you, which is very interesting.
Yep.
Well,
and lest all this sound too hard to do, let me spend 1 minute in closing and saying it is the best of times when you get to invent something yourself and see it out in the world, being adopted by thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or even millions of people, and know that you helped birth that thing. I don't know what else there is in life that's much better than that. I mean, it, professionally anyway.
Professional birther.
It is the best. Yeah, it's why we all do this. It's just so fun to do. It's so rewarding.
Well, good. On that word, I'm going to end our conversation, Eileen, and tell you thank you so much for all your honesty and your directness. And wow, what a history, and the ups and the downs, and multiple learnings, multiple serial from, you know, inventions and reinventions. And I so appreciate you spending your time with the Covey Club through the Covey Cast and talking to my members about your experience. And I hope that is rewarding to you as well. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Leslie. Thanks for the invitation.
I want to thank you all for listening to the CoveyCast and this interview with Eileen Gittens, who's the former founder of Blurb and the current founder of BossyGirl.com. I'm so amazed by her honesty and her directness and her wonderful tips for being lifelong learners, which I know all of us are, and how that leads you to your next project and to ultimate happiness as you go forward in your great life and want to live your most authentic life. If you love CoveyCast, I hope you will subscribe to us and you will listen to all the other podcasts. It would also be wonderful if you love CoveyCast and what we're doing for women of a certain age to talk about being entrepreneurs or creating systems for women who are slightly older to reinvent themselves. I hope you will pass the word along and I hope you will rate us. You can find us on podbean.com, that's with an N, and also in the iTunes store. And we would love your rating if you like it, and if you could post it out there, give us some comments, and also you can always email me, Leslie, L-E-S-L-E-Y, at coveyclub.com with your ideas about people to interview. Maybe you have a great reinvention story. I'd love to hear about it. And also, I would love to hear your comments about what we could do better on the podcast to provide you with the answers and the inspiration for you to live your most authentic life and to keep on being a lifelong learner. So thank you very much, and I will talk to you soon.